My name is Stephanie, and I am an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is September the 8th, 2015. And let's face it, I would rather be sitting in my corner chair over there listening to somebody else speak today. But I know that this is a gift of the program. It's a huge gift for me to tell my story, and it's a gift to give back, because whether or not I say any of the right things, God will use me today to speak to someone. So I'm very glad for that. So I used to start my story when I would talk about my family, saying that I was a child of a Marine. And people would just stop me there and they would just say, okay, well, we get it. Your life sucked. And I'm so glad that with the gift of this program, I can reframe that. I was the child of a man who went to Vietnam, who came back and suffered from a horrible PTSD. And his fear became my fear. And it shaped my life. And I learned to be very small. And afraid of everything, afraid of the world. And I just wanted to conform. I didn't want anybody to pay attention to me. And I didn't really notice the theme of alcohol in our family or in our lives, except for that everybody likes to tell the story of how I offered the Baptist preacher a beer when I was 3. So apparently there must have been something to that at that time. But again, I learned fear very early. I learned to stay out of my dad's way. I learned how to cope with the world, with the fear that he had. And he became a very driven man to conquer a lot of things. And so I learned a lot of my pride from him, my pride to succeed, my pride to... It's really like I felt like I had to compete with everybody all the time, that I was going to be in a fight for the rest of my life to get anything that I wanted. So I really don't remember a lot about my childhood, but I do remember just being awkward, wanting to be small, and just not wanting to have a lot of attention. So a lot of people talk about how they wish they could be the same size that they were in high school. Well, I am the same size that I was in the 5th grade. So in the 5th grade, I was 5'9", had size 10 feet. And so being awkward and small was not possible. I was going to be awkward and large. And so I got a lot of unwanted attention. I couldn't hide very well. And I just had a lot of fear. I just had a lot of fear. And I couldn't figure out why. And I just couldn't fit in anywhere. I learned to stay away from home. I started abusing myself. So I guess I didn't know about cutting. So I actually had a baseball bat, and I would just bounce it off my head, and it would be under my hairline and nobody would know. But it was a way to release some of the fear that I had. So it's just, I look back and it was just odd, you know, just very odd. But nobody really knew. I was just kind of the underachiever. I just wanted to fly under the radar. I didn't want anybody to be anybody's shining star. I just wanted them to ignore me. So, I never found alcohol. I was too scared. I never found drugs. I literally was just too scared to do anything, and I was paralyzed by that. So I remember in high school, I was dating a guy, and we went to Pizza Hut, and we were hanging out with another couple, and we were out in the parking lot, and the other guy had bought a 4-pack of wine coolers. Well, you would have thought that was kryptonite. He sat it down in the parking space, and I was freaking out. I thought I was going to be arrested. I wouldn't even drink the wine cooler. I was just like, we have to get away. I mean, I was so scared of everything. I didn't know. I mean, I could have probably said who the druggies were in high school, but I never knew where to get anything. But I did learn about the prescription dose. So my mom was a nurse, and so, you know, if Tylenol said you take 2 for a headache, we learned that the prescription dose would mean 4. So usually as a nurse would double everything because the doctor said that would be allowed. So I always already had the disease of more because we took more of everything. And just because. It wasn't even that two wouldn't have worked. So I did learn that, and I did have happy times. I mean, I had some friends. I just never, ever fit in. And I think that that's a common theme that I hear when everybody tells their story, is there's just some way that they didn't fit in. So high school came, and I had two great things in high school. I had a church youth group that I just adored. Had a youth pastor who was an amazing man who just, you know, gave out a lot of unconditional love. But I still didn't get it because I really thought that I had to be a good person to fit in, for God to love me, because I didn't have a father figure that loved me or that showed love. And so I really didn't know what that meant. So I can remember when, you know, we would be charged to save the world or whatever, and I would carry my Bible to school, so I mean that made me even more awkward back at that time. And I can remember, you know, talking to my friends going, so how many people did you talk to today about Jesus? You know, it was kind of like, you know, a task list. If I could write down that I talked to three people, maybe I would get into heaven. So I kind of felt that way. But the other thing was I wrote her a thank you note this week, but I had amazing instructor. I was in the chorus in high school, and I could not sing. That was not my gift. How I made it into choir, I don't know, because you had to audition. But Dr. Gillis, she saw that there was a song in my heart that I needed to share. For 4 years, I sang in that choir, that poor choir, but it was such a blessing to me. And I think that, you know, some of those things, some of those gifts that God put into my life really kept me alive, probably. They really kept me alive. So I knew I had a heart for people. I knew that even though I didn't feel accepted, that I wanted other people to feel accepted. So I wanted to do something to give back. And in the 80s, everybody in China was starving. That was what was on TV. And so everybody was sending food to China. And so I decided I wanted to be in the Peace Corps. So I was a geographic well before the alcohol even came into play, because I wanted to run and I wanted to get away. And so I was determined to go into the Peace Corps. And my dad said, you will not go into the Peace Corps. And he literally dropped me off at Georgia Tech a week after my high school graduation. Talk about not fitting in. I definitely didn't fit in at Georgia Tech. I ended up being roommates. There were three of us, which is never good for girls. And I was the one who was left out. I luckily made a couple of friends, and I handled it for a little while. Just trying to, again, find out how to be good enough, how to fly under the radar. I only got drunk one time at Tech. I can remember one night, and I hated it, and it wasn't even fun. But at Georgia Tech was the first time that I attempted suicide. I didn't even know how to do that. So a couple Tylenol later, I was rushed to the hospital, and discharged, left Georgia Tech, and came home. To a house that I hated with a whole bunch more shame, because now I couldn't even make it out in the world on my own. So as I'm looking for love in all the wrong places and all the acceptance, I found my husband, and I didn't know he was my husband at the time, but I think he was really just a pawn. He wasn't driven, and I think that I thought I could control him, right? Or I could fix him, or maybe he at least wouldn't be a threat to me. I think more will be revealed there. But so looking for love in all the wrong places, and I got pregnant. And so, let's just piss my dad off a little bit more by doing everything backwards and everything wrong. So at the age of 20, I'm pregnant, and so of course the thing to do was to get married. So why not marry to somebody you don't even really like a whole lot? But it was okay because now I had a purpose. I had a purpose to be a mom, and Morgan was the answer to my prayers. She's amazing. I love her very much. And so I had Morgan, and now I had this instant family that I needed to make work, and I was going to figure out how to do it. And for a long time, it worked. I could control things. I could be at everybody's Christmas party. I was people pleasing, trying to make everybody happy. And you know, I got a lot of good attention because now I had the baby and everybody wanted to see the baby. Well, and still trying to find out who I was and needing income, because here we are, young married couple, not making any money, I started working for a bank. And there I found a place that accepted me, who accepted my skills and just really, really loved me. And I made a career out of it. And I was really good at it because I love to please people. And I love people who loved me. So I went back and I got my degree at night, and Macy was born. And so I've got two beautiful girls, and I'm getting promotion after promotion and just doing great. And you know, I didn't really care about my marriage, unfortunately, because I was getting all my love and acceptance through my job. And so I continued to rise there, but you know, it was all a mask. It was all the people pleasing was a mask. All of the accolades were a mask, because I never even knew from the day I was born who I was, because I always lived my life in fear. And what I didn't understand is, even though I was getting a lot of acceptance now, I still had so much fear, because all of that could fall apart. And so I didn't have a whole lot of boundaries. I was people pleasing, and the stress of sales catches up with you. And so I started taking antidepressants and going to the doctor, and they just were like, oh, you have the hurried woman syndrome. You know, so much is being asked of you. And you know, nobody ever told me that there could be a spiritual answer to any of this. You know, I went to church. I loved God. You know, I had parents. They're both still alive. I had people in my life, but nobody ever told me that you don't have to live this way. You don't have to struggle every minute of every day. And boy, I didn't even realize what kind of struggle I was about to face. So 2006 and 2007 were probably the hardest years of my life. So I was doing great work. I was a SVP of a bank. I was a financial planner, making money hand over fist, trying to, you know, do everything I could for my children and my family. And I had gained a lot of weight. I was on a lot of antidepressants. I was unhappy with the way I looked. And so in 2006, I decided to have weight loss surgery, because I could, because I had money. And because I thought that would make me feel better. Well, when you desire to feel small, when all of a sudden you lose a lot of weight, you get a lot of attention. It was a lot of attention that I wasn't prepared for. I was also in the financial planning world. You wine and dine everybody. So we would do three at three. And it started out just three at three on Fridays, but then it became three at three every day. I was a fan of like frozen drinks, you know, the fruity drinks, because again, I had no idea what being an real alcoholic or somebody who knew how to drink was like. So I drank all the sugary crap. Well, when I had like weight loss surgery, I couldn't do that anymore. So then it entered the world of just having, you know, like gin and tonics and things like that. And boy, you could drink those, and you could drink them a lot faster than you could these fruity drinks. And they hit a lot harder. But you know what? A lot of that stress started going away. And I started enjoying things. And I started to have a smile on my face. And I started to forget about stuff. And I really liked that. I really liked that. So, you know, it was just, it was what it was, and it wasn't a problem at first. Like anybody else's. But in 2007, Morgan, who's my firstborn, started fainting uncontrollably. I mean, she wouldn't get an aura or anything. She'd just be up and down before you could think about it, and busting her face and all this kind of stuff. Well, as supermom, I was going to fix this. We were going to figure this out. And we went to every doctor and test after test and, you know, fall after fall and trying to figure it all out. And finally, the cardiologist told me that they thought she had what's called a long QT wave. And that is an electrical issue that if your heart beats twice during the time of the electrical impulse resetting, then you will have a heart attack. And most of these patients die. Whoa. I really thought I was in control of my life. And this is the first time that I had no control. And the most precious thing in my life was in danger. And so the cardiologist proceeds to tell me that I should buy a portable defibrillator to have on hand because they just don't survive. That kind of fear was exponential, and I just didn't know what to do with it. And the only relief I've ever had in my life is drinking. So that sounded like a great idea. So I started drinking at home, just to ease the pain, to try to get through the next doctor's appointment. My husband was not really involved. His best coping skill was just denial. And of course, I really didn't want him to be involved anyway, to be honest with it. So I was going to take care of everything. So I was really doing a whole lot of this just on my own. I didn't have any real friends, confidants, people I could discuss things with. And so we were dealing with that. Well, when Morgan started dealing with the fact of her, you know, mortality and things going on, she was in high school, and we found out that the year before, she had never shared with us, but as she's dealing with some emotional issues, that she had actually been raped in high school. Man, that pit got a whole lot deeper and a whole lot darker. And so I did what supermoms do, and I tried to rescue my child and ran her off to counseling. But it never occurred to me that I needed help too. So I just drank more. I drank more often. And was drinking at home. At this point, I still wasn't drinking in the morning or drinking at work, but it was just getting more frequent and more frequent because I had no coping skills. I didn't know how to do this. This wasn't supposed to happen to me. So as I started drinking more, I started having consequences because as my kids were older, they didn't like that I was drinking, and my husband actually didn't like that I was drinking. So I did what any good instinct is that has gone awry, and I started to run. So what that means is I would get in my car and I would go somewhere and drink. I wouldn't drink at a bar. I wasn't going to drink with anybody. I mean, God, I'm a self-respected financial planner. Nobody's going to see me this way, right? So I'm going to drink alone in my car, which made a whole lot more sense at that time. So in 2010, I had my first DUI. I had run. I had stayed in my car all night, which that should have been the first clue that this wasn't such a great thing, because that wasn't the first time I had done that. And so I didn't even get my DUI till the next morning. And I freaked out. I was just like, oh my God, I don't do this. This is not acceptable. What do I do? And so I ran to Ridgeview and I did an intensive outpatient program. And I came here. I came to the Owl Place in 2010, met my sponsor that I have today. So glad that she was amazing. But I tell you what, something happened when I came in this room, my very first meeting, and I picked up a white chip. people loved me. They hugged me. I felt like a prom queen. It was the weirdest feeling ever. But they were like, welcome home. Like, we're so glad you're here. And it was just shocking. Well, because I was still, hadn't figured out the spiritual experience thing, and the fact that, hey, I got sober for about 6 months, I thought I could handle it. Of course, I stopped coming because I'm feeling better. I've completed the treatment program, and actually changed jobs. So I changed companies. I thought, well, the stress is bad at this company. This company's not as big. Maybe I can ride it out before it gets stressful. Changed jobs, and I would start binge drinking. So I would go for months, be fine, but then a week to 10 days, I would be stinking drunk for a long time. And because I was good at my job, I could, and I was people pleaser and everybody loved me, I could get away with it. I could just go MIA. Nobody really cared as long as I made my sales goals. And so it worked for a while. It was killing my family. It was just, you know, doing irreparable damage. But I was still praying to God of what I ever understood, you know, please save my marriage, please save my family, please do something about this, you know, please help me not to drive drunk, whatever it was. So in 2012, my boundaries were gone. Everybody was trying to intervene in my life and tell me that I needed to fix this. And that was my husband's thought was, I don't know what you're going through. I really don't care what you're going through. You need to get your shit together and let me know when you fix this. My parents didn't really want to be involved. They would be glad to pay for an IOP or whatever I wanted to go to, but they just wanted me to fix it too. And that really came down to the fact that both of my parents are in active addiction. And you know what? They would have to look in the mirror if they were going to get me treatment. And so they just weren't going to be involved either. And my kids want me just to fix it. But you know what? They're kids. This wasn't their deal. And this wasn't what they signed up for. So in 2012, God gave me God's given me many, many gifts. So that's not true. They're not my first gift. God gave me a huge gift in finally putting the nail in the coffin of my marriage. In 2012, I found out that my husband was cheating, and God knew that that was a non-negotiable with me, and he was going to be gone. So I kicked him out the day I found out, and I felt this huge sense of relief, and it was like, okay, now I'm not going to have to drink, because of course he was the problem, and so now I can go on with my life, and things will get better, and I'll be in control again, right? And so I let everything was kind of going along because anger will fuel you for a very long time. And anger was fueling me and I wasn't having to drink because I was getting high off my anger, of him and, of what he had done to me. And so about six weeks went by. First of all, I was not in recovery when I went through my divorce, so I did say a whole lot of stuff that I can't really say that I'm not happy that I said. I'm glad that I said it all. Glad that I didn't have a sponsor at that time who told me to take the high road because I got to get it all out. So now I can make an amends if I so choose. Anyway, apparently that's something I still need to work on. So 6 weeks after he had left, everything was going fine. And if any of you are, have LinkedIn, kind of Facebook for business, you can see the past five people who have searched your profile. And sure enough, if it wasn't the girl he was cheating with, well, you had just done poked the bear in the cage. And I was pissed. I was like, okay, I had let this go. You were out of my life. But you know what? Now I'm going to find your husband. Because we knew that she worked with my husband, that my sister had called up the day we found out and had left a message and said, we know about the affair. Do you want to tell your husband or should we? You know, like a nice little veiled threat. And we had found out that the woman had quit her job the next day. And so that was kind of revenge for me. And so I kind of let it go because I thought, well, she's trying to save her marriage. I got out of my marriage. Win-win. Let it go. But when 6 weeks later, when she looked me up, I got a little pissy. And so with that, I decided I was going to find her husband. Well, I couldn't find her husband. And I didn't know why I couldn't find her husband, because you can pay for every service everywhere and you can find somebody. But this man just didn't exist. And my sister and I finally found a phone number that actually worked. And she called it and left a message and said, you know, we're trying to find so-and-so. She didn't get a call back, but we knew it was a working number. So she texted this number that night and said, look, we're trying to find the husband because there's an affair and we just want to let you know. And she got a text back and said, we would like to talk to you about this. So I got my sister let me know and said, would you be willing to talk? And I said, yes. And so I ended up talking to this man's brother. And God works out his timing perfectly, because this man was serving in Afghanistan. And if I had found him 6 weeks sooner, he wouldn't have been on his way home. So at least he was on his way home. He wasn't going to have to deal with this information when he was over there. And I was able to let his brother know what's going on, and that's how it was going to be. So when he landed, got back in the U.S., he called me for the details. I gave it to him, and he said, well, you just handle your business, I'll handle mine. It was like, okay, great. So everything just went on. I used my anger for a lot longer time period. And about a month after I had last talked to that man, he called me and he said, look, I just want to check on your girls. How are you doing? And I said, you know, we're doing well. We're doing okay. And he said, well, would you ever be interested in just getting together and having a drink? Sure. Sure. Well, guys, that man was Kyle. So, in a very Jerry Springer way, Kyle and I have exchanged spouses. But God is good, because I definitely got the better end of the deal. So Kyle is now in my life, and we knew because of his divorce, had taken another assignment in Arkansas and was going to be leaving, so we were just having a good time. But after a couple months, we decided we were going to try to make this work. And what was really cool was Kyle's dad was an alcoholic, very severe alcoholic, and his dad died of this disease when he was 21. And he loved his dad dearly. So I had a man, God put a man in my life who understood me and understood that I was not my disease. And that was a huge, huge gift. So he would never belittle me or anything like that. He just kept telling me, I just want you to quit sabotaging yourself. But he would still let me drink, and he would still drink with me. And things would be great for a while, and things would get really bad for a while. But in 2013, I received my second DUI. And I was here, and Kyle was in Arkansas. My dad, I tried to talk to my dad about how I had PTSD with everything that Morgan had gone through and all this kind of stuff. And he proceeded to tell me that I had no idea what I was talking about. And I was so, the darkness of not being able to control my drinking and everything I was going through, because I really thought like I had changed irreparably, that there was no going back, that I could never be a good person again, that I had lost all control, and it was over for me. And so in 2013 was my second suicide attempt. I just took extra sleeping pills, and it really wasn't ever that I just didn't want to live. I just didn't want to live like this anymore, that this was horrible. And so In 2013, I retired from financial planning before they could fire me, is really what it was. But it's just a more politically correct way to say it. So I went out to Arkansas for a little while, lived with Kyle. Things were great because, of course, I relocated and had a fresh start. But things weren't, I wasn't going to AA. I wasn't having any kind of program. So things were just going as they were going. And so Kyle came back home after a year and moved in with me. And again, he's just been a true gift to me. But his family is from Alaska. And so he had a trip to go home. And we really couldn't afford for both of us to go. So I stayed home. And I flipped out. And I started drinking before his plane even left the airport. And I had my third DUI that night. And I was done. I was toast. I didn't want to live. I didn't want to. I was just. It just wasn't me. It wasn't acceptable. What in the hell was going on? And that's all I could think of. And so, luckily, he didn't leave me over that. He spent his trip, you know, probably a miserable trip in Alaska because here I was at home. He came back again, stopped drinking for a little while, and then we went to Panama City for Labor Day of 2015. And I got drunk and I left the room when he was taking a shower. And I don't remember anything except for that he put me in the car and brought me home. And that was probably our, you know, that was the most serious conversation we had because he was just like, I can't do it anymore. I can't help you. And I knew it. And again, nobody in my family was going to help me. And we decided that I needed to go to treatment. And so all I remember is getting home. I grew up Baptist. I remember in my mamaw's church, the hymns, and I could just hear in my head, "It is well with my soul." And I just walked around that house singing that in my head for 3 days before I got into treatment. I went to Penfield Christian Homes, which is the Heart Campus out in Livonia, Georgia. And to tell you that my parents are so dysfunctional, they sent me flowers to rehab. So I just can't get over the irony of that. So I went there and God used Nanny Cindy, this woman who must be 400 pounds if she's an ounce, who just hugged all of the darkness out of me. And I picked up my Bible and the community surrounding me, and for the first time I could go back and see where 2,000 years ago they documented in Romans that we do the things we do not want to do, that somebody already knew what I would be going through, and that there was a God that loved me, even though I can, you know, continue to struggle with that. So that was so freeing. I definitely had my spiritual experience there, and I will be forever grateful for that place. So I came back, but y'all, we still have to pay consequences, right? So I can't just have a spiritual experience and everything be great. So I live in Cobb County, and I was sentenced to Cobb DUI court. And I know a lot of people worry about those of us who are sent back in the rooms to get our papers signed, but y'all, it saved my life. It saved my life. Anybody who will enter these doors for any reason has a chance, and I hope we all keep that in mind. Because DUI court, I started having friends who I actually lived out this way, so we came to meetings together. It helped me stay in the middle of the bed getting that paper signed because I needed to come. And I learned to make friends again. I learned to make friends here. And so even if I didn't want to come for a meeting, I would come to have coffee with you. I would come to see you and to look forward to seeing you. And that's what kept me coming back. God put in a whole lot of things in these last 3 years. I had to get a job with DUI court. So on somebody else's Facebook post that I was prowling around trying to find a job, I found Papa's Pantry. It's a food assistance and training ministry. It was 32 hours a week, which you had to work 32 hours a week in DUI court. And I applied for the job. I'm way overqualified for this job, but I wrote a cover letter about wanting to be in service, which was totally true. I had had my spiritual experience. I wanted to serve others. And I wanted to give back. And so they actually brought me in, interviewed me, and then came the background check. Well, they wouldn't hire me. They wouldn't hire me because of 3 DUIs. And, you know, I can't blame them, right? You got to have standards. And I wouldn't meet the standards right then. But what was really cool is God never told me that I told you to serve to get paid. So I asked them if I could volunteer, and they said yes. And I volunteered twice. 2 days I volunteered, and the third day that I came in, the person they had hired for the job was being transferred to Texas. Her husband's job had changed. And the director looked at me, called me into her office, and said, I have unanimous board approval to hire you. Do you still want the job? And so I say, God moved somebody to Texas for me. So that was awesome. And a year later, one of the ladies retired, and I became the advocacy director. And what that means is I do the client intake, so I get to sit with people and hear their stories. And I get to use all of this, what felt like so much pain, to be able to empathize with other people and understand what they're going through. But I was still paying for my consequences, y'all. DUI court's no joke, a year, if you're perfect. And I tried to be pretty perfect, and I got to phase 5. I'd just been promoted to advocacy director, and I was in phase 5, and I got a positive on a drug screen. And I had gotten a false positive back right when DUI court had started, so I thought, no promise, it's send it off, it's no big deal or whatever. And she called me on a Friday afternoon, and she said, we sent it off, it's retested, it's positive. And I said, that can't be, because it's not true. Wasn't true. And so they wanted me to come in the next week and all this kind of stuff. And I was going to jail. So you have to go to jail for 2 days. I was just like, God, why would this happen? So I said, no, I said, I can't do it. Then I've got to work. I can't lose this job. I love this job. And I said, I want to come now. Can the judge see me today? And this was a Friday afternoon. And they made concessions. And so I called some of my friends and the ones who had been to Cobb County Jail, which ironically, I've never been to Cobb County Jail. All my DUIs were from running, so they were all in different counties. They told me, they said, you need to bundle up, it's going to be cold, blah, blah, blah. So, it's the middle of summer, I'm dressed from head to toe in sweatshirts and all this, and I'm going to court to meet with the judge. I called Kyle, he came home. I called some of my mentors from Hart when I was there, and one lady, Laura, she goes, Stephanie, you just go in there and you be Paul. Paul from the Bible was imprisoned and a great preacher. And I just sat on the front porch and I'm crying. I'm like, Laura, I don't want to be Paul. I don't want to be Paul. That's not my job. Please don't let me be Paul. And so I went to court and I'm standing in front of the judge. Well, I went to court and we waited. We waited like an hour and 15 minutes. The judge was late. And I got up in front of that judge and he said, we got your positive. And I said, yes, sir. And I have to tell you that it is not true. That my God and I know that my sobriety date is September 8, 2015. And I work in a job that helps people like me now. And it's not true. And so in a courtroom of six, I was able to give my testimony. And the judge looked at me and he said, "We believe you." And that was unprecedented because they don't believe you. They don't believe you. So God was in that place for sure. But he said, "But we do have to sanction you because we have to." And they gave me 16 hours of community service that I had to scramble. But you know what? That was a blessing, right? Because I had to tell my testimony, and somebody there must have heard, needed to hear something I had to say. What's really cool right now is that the court officer for DUI court that I've gotten to know, his last name is Church. He has become a good friend to the pantry, and they actually support us now. And so I get to work with him on outside issues, as he saw me go through all my inside issues. So God has used this job in a really cool way. Being that I was in sales and networking, all that's been my gift. I've done that for the pantry and gotten a lot of miscellaneous partners. So November, a little over a year ago, I went down to the Women and Men's Extension and asked Robert Jordan if we could come teach classes to the men and women, help them get better jobs before they transition, was my goal. And I am not the trainer. And he looked at me and he said, "You're the answer to my prayers." And I was like, "Who are you talking to?" And he said, "You are the answer to my prayers. I need a life skills trainer. Will you please come be our life skills trainer?" And I said, "Okay, can I pray about it?" And he said, "Yes." So this was a Friday afternoon, and by Monday, I was jumping up and down, just excited to do it. And I tell you what, if that hasn't been the blessing of a lifetime, I, every week on Tuesday nights, teach at the Men's Extension, topics out of a notebook, and I've been able to relate them to the 12 steps and just talk openly with them about what it's like to be an adult in recovery. And these men bless me so much. I've been at their graduations, I've been at their baptisms. I love them and they love me. And so God has blessed me with a whole family of love and acceptance that I never even knew that I longed for so much in my life, and given me a peace. God's also allowed me to lose people in recovery. A good friend of mine, Matt, which a lot of you know, we lost this past year. Everybody knows I'm still mad at him. That he and I will go round and round one day. But it's also instilled in me that we are to share our stories, that we are to share our demons, that if we don't get us out, they will kill us. And that's what's important today. So today, this nonprofit that wouldn't hire me 2.5 years ago has asked me to be their executive director in succession planning. And y'all, God has told me to turn it down because he has bigger things for me. And you know what? I trust him. And I have no idea what that means, but I know that that's true. I'm going to be a grandmother in March. My youngest daughter, Macy, is pregnant. And I probably had my greatest compliment just in the last few weeks. Macy came to tell us about it. And then she went told my other older daughter that she was going to be an aunt. And she was telling my older daughter, she said, "I was so worried about what mom was going to say." And my older daughter looked at her and she goes, "Why were you worried about mom? She's all kumbaya and shit now." So I think that's probably the best compliment to my spiritual fitness that I've had the whole time I've been in recovery. Y'all, this is a life of peace, of love, of friendship, of truth, and honesty that I never even knew existed. And it's all because of the 12 steps of AA. It's all because I chose to keep coming back. It's all because I have a sponsor. The Hell Place, It's all because of God and the fact that I finally surrendered. I surrendered what I didn't even know I needed to surrender. I just finally gave up and let somebody take the wheel. And I thank God, and I thank all of you very much.